Welcome to the PhoenixCast, a podcast about cybersecurity, technology, and innovation issues in the military. We are your hosts, John,
Rich,
and Kyle.
Rich and I are both U.S. Marines, and the opinions expressed on the cast are those of the host, not official military policy.
And the opinions expressed by myself are my own, not those of my employer or any other business that I am associated with.
For today's episode, we have a very special guest, Gene Kim, author of The Phoenix Project and namesake of this very podcast. Thanks so much for coming on the cast. Could you provide a quick intro for us?
Hey, I am so delighted to be here with you. I am actually a huge fan of your Phoenix cast. I've listened to so many of them, and I've just been dazzled by what you are spearheading through the organization. So about me, I've been studying high-performing technology organizations for 23 years, and that was a journey that started back in 99 when I was the CTO and founder of a company called Tripwire in the information security space. And so as you can imagine, in a 23-year journey, there were many surprises, but by far for me, the biggest surprise was how it took me into the middle of the DevOps movement, which I think is so urgent and important regardless of what industry we compete in. And so my area of passion since 2014 is studying not so much the Facebooks, Amazon, Netflix, and Googles, and Microsofts of the world, but really large, complex organizations that have been around for decades or centuries that are using those same principles and patterns to, you know, compete and win in the marketplace. And I understand that in your industry, compete and win has a slightly different connotation, but no less important, maybe more important.
Yes, the competing and the winning normally ends up having rifles, but same focus and emphasis on winning 100%. So what we're going to do is something a little bit different. Normally, we just go right into, bam, firing some questions. But what we wanted to start this one off with is letting the audience know, hey, you know, what did this book mean to us and how do we kind of put it into action? So I'll start off. 2 years ago, I was in New York City at Morgan Stanley, a working internship that the Marine Corps put me on. And I got a call from Rich and he said, hey man, yeah, you're coming to work with me over where we work together. And he said, all I need you to do before you come here is read this book and get ready to put it into action. So this marked, I think, the first time in my career I had ever been contacted and told, read this before you show up. And then actually being able to read a book and immediately my mind just started whizzing. And I hadn't even, you know, checked in. I didn't even really know what we were working on. But the gears, they're turning. And I'm thinking to myself, yes, I am ready to do this. I don't think those two things had never happened to me. I'd never been given homework before showing up to a job. I'd also never so quickly been able to internalize and think about taking a concept that I had read and immediately put into action. So this was a really interesting and really special moment for me. Rich, was your experience somewhat similar? Obviously, you told me to read the book, so you had a different experience, but was it something like that?
Yeah, very much so, John. So one, you coming to work for us has probably been one of the awesome things that I've got to experience in our current roles. So a little love there. But yeah, so my experience with the Phoenix Project was specifically related to how in my role before I came back on active duty and into the Marine Corps, I was working doing security engineering at Amazon, right? And I had the opportunity to watch all the principles that get talked through the book in action. And so I think very much so like Gene's intro when he talks about, you know, studying large organizations and wanting to like help them succeed. I just had this affinity of how can I give back to the Marine Corps all the amazing skills they gave me from a, you know, bias for action, leadership capabilities that I would have never gotten had I not been in the Marine Corps specifically. So to your question specifically, John, what really motivated me in the book was how to deliver effectively against the security results that the government and the DoD wanted us to deliver against, and more specifically, how to enable the rest of the Marine Corps from a technology perspective to do its main objectives, right? And I think Gene and I have kind of similar experience. I'm sure Kyle does as well. You know, working security like you did at Tripwire, right? You generally get looked at as the folks that somebody has to clear a hurdle through in order to deliver some value or functionality. And in my maturity, in my previous role, in my current role, it was like, how do we make this an enabler to the business achieving its objective and delivering value for its customers. So that's really where I got my inspiration from your book, Gene and John. Yes, you coming to work and helping us do that has been awesome. So Kyle, I'm sure you have something similar to say, but I'll hand it off to you for your inspiration.
Yeah. So my journey is a little bit different than you guys, where I feel like you started a little ahead of the curve for me. I got out of the military in 2013. And in 2013, if we jump back in the time machine, I feel like the hot, sexy new thing that was super trendy to say you were, but even though you might not know exactly how to do it, was this thing called DevOps. And everyone was sort of like, ooh, DevOps is hot. And oh, I'm going to be a DevOps engineer and all this sort of stuff. And I got out in 2013 having no idea about any of this DevOpsy stuff, right? I was just I was a cyber guy in the military. I was a warrant officer. That's what I did. But there are three particular people who had a massive influence on me when I got out. And this podcast represents me collecting the third and final Pokemon in my Pokemon game of most influential people in my life, because there was Nathan Harvey at Chef, who I ended up meeting when I worked at Google. He also works at Google now. There were the people who did the Obama campaign on AWS, which their particular architectures and methodologies were heavily, heavily influential to me. I ended up working for both of those people by total random happenstance when I got my job at Google. And then I followed those people to the company that I work at currently. And then there was Gene Kim. And I don't put him last likely here because he was likely the most influential one, because the Phoenix Project came out in 2013. Coincidentally, and very fatefully, the year I got out of the military. And when all this sexy hotness was happening with DevOps, this was the book that everybody talked about. And Gene Kim was this rock star of a DevOps guy at the time, right? You were speaking at like every conference you could, and I read every blog post you ever wrote. I have my fourth copy of the DevOps handbook here because I give them away to the people that I work with and say, you must read this. And because of that, the influence that Gene has had on my ability to do everything that I do today, which is help, you know, large multi-million dollar organizations figure out how they're going to adopt cloud and do things like help people understand what DevOps and SRE mean to them, cannot be measured. It's literally immeasurable in all shapes and sizes. So for the listeners that are out there, if you started this cast like, who is this Gene Kim fella? I am just telling you that you need to go read generally everything that Gene has written. Start with the Phoenix Project, work your way to the Unicorn Project, and then get to the DevOps Handbook. And I feel like you will be a much better person all around, whether it's technically, personally, professionally, whatever you want to say. And I can't give enough of a like, just go read it, add it to cart immediately, prime overnight that thing today, because it's a big, big deal. So without further ado, I'm going to kick it back over to you, John, to sort of lead us into this first line of questioning.
By the way, thanks so much for the kind words. It is a bit much, but certainly, and I just have a tremendous amount of admiration for courage it takes to overcome older ways of working, where there are plenty of people who are very invested in doing the way that it's always been done, 20, 30 years. So that really has been an area of deep study for me, is studying kind of these leaders that it takes to overthrow these very powerful entrenched orthodoxies. And so kudos to all of you. And I've just been loving these interviews that you've been putting together.
Thanks so much. And on that note, I kind of thought, hey, so Gene Kim is definitely the DevOps guy, but why military? And I actually had why military as a question previously, but you answered it already on the Ideal Cast, the most recent episode you had with Admiral Richardson, a former Navy CNO, Chief of Naval Operations, so like the highest active duty person in the Navy. And you had him on and you said, hey, I am drawn to the military because you believe the military is at the perfect time and ready to really embrace DevOps. Is there anything in particular that makes you think that? Is it a confluence of things? Is it the technology? Is it the mindset? Is it the place and time? What makes you think that we are ready for this?
Yeah, and I don't think it's an assessment of readiness whatsoever. It's just my observation that I've seen enough data points that has really caught my attention. And I think the claim the hypothesis I'm putting out there is that it will actually be the Department of Defense that will mobilize faster to the digital disruption agenda, even faster than the commercial counterparts, right? Which in most cases, people sort of look at the DoD as generally trailing that of commercial, especially in technology. But I think there's probably two things at work. One is in the DoD, there is a thinking adversary who is just as eager to exploit technology to their advantage, as opposed to ours. And two is, it just especially came up in my interviews when I got to interview Dave Silverman. So he's one of the co-authors of the Team of Teams book. He was a lieutenant commander in the Navy SEALs. And, what I started to really appreciate is that the amount of investment that the military puts into training its leaders. There was an observation made that I think they're talking to the top executives at a large commercial organization, and both he and General McChrystal were both astounded at how little formal training the top executive had, in comparison to, I think it was stated, somewhere between 5 to 7 years of formal postgraduate education that is, achieved when you're a senior military leader. So I have to imagine that investment is good for something, right? So one, it will either be, very useful as, we try to adapt and change, or it's actually a total waste of time, right? And there's actually activity, training that shouldn't be happening. And I really doubt it's a second. And so that's why I've been so eager to really study what is it about that's at play when we see these software factories being stood up, whether it's Kessel Run. So Adam Furtado, the branch chief there, I talked to Brian Kroger, one of the other founders who was a captain in the Air Force and now left. And they co-presented with Lauren Knausenberger, deputy CIO. Whether it's in the U.S. Air Force, whether it's in Army, Marine Corps, as so brilliantly described in your podcast, and in the U.S. Navy as well. So, and especially after talking with Admiral John Richardson, I really seems to shore up this belief that, leadership matters, and there's much that's not really talked about that I think is important, when you're doing something as disruptive and requires something with so much coordination needs as technology and really trying to integrate it into daily operations of a vast organization.
Well, let's talk about the integration of that stuff into a vast organization, because that's a perfect segue for us. So we've already established that we generally like your work, Gene, and we threw around this quote a little earlier that if von Clausewitz was in IT, and everyone who's listening to this podcast, you better know who that is, Gene Kim would have been one of his top generals. I have no doubt about this, because in my opinion, after reading the Phoenix Project years and years ago, the thing I loved most about it is that I could directly apply the three ways into my military way of thinking and immediately apply that to the jobs that I now had in the civilian sector. And for those of you listening who have not read the book, go do it. But there are three ways that Gene sort of outlines that identify how good organizations should operate. And I'm going to give a super quick TLDR on this. The first way is flow and systems thinking, which emphasizes the performance of the entire system as opposed to the performance of a specific like silo of work or department. The second way, which is feedback loops, the goal of almost any process anywhere is going to be involving initiative and improving that initiative to shorten and amplify feedback loops so that we can make corrections and be like continuously improving. And the third way is a culture of continuous experimentation and learning. So this is about creating a culture that fosters two things: continual experimentation and taking risks and learning from failure, and understanding that repetition and practice are the prerequisites to mastery. So that's a super TLDR on these three things. And so if we talk about the first way, which is the flow and systems ways of thinking and things like that, I immediately applied that to sort of big blue arrows, knowing your battlefield, knowing your enemy, and keeping your head on a swivel. And these things were like, they clicked immediately as I read the story. And generally speaking, I want to sort of kick this idea around that if we had to clarify this, that first way, big blue arrow, head in a swivel, all that stuff. The second way, which is feedback loops, which to me was like, Gene's talking about the OODA loop. That's exactly right. What Gene's talking about, right?
The honorary Marine.
Yes, exactly, right? We stole from the Air Force anyway, so it's all good. And this OODA loop directly applies to that second way, which is continuous feedback, right? Making sure that you are shortening those loops, getting immediate information from anywhere on the battlefield or anywhere in your information space or anywhere in your combat area so that you can make better, faster decisions to influence the future state of the battlefield or whatever you're trying to accomplish. And that third way, I think the Marine Corps does a fabulous job of this continuous experimentation and learning. We've got, every MCDP, we've got the Commandant's Reading List. And generally speaking, this spoke to my JJ did tie buckle and BAMSIS, which is the military's leadership principles and troop leading steps, which is just a complicated way of saying, don't suck, do things right, and follow a set of principles. And this, I think, applies directly to military life and military execution of everything that we do on a day-to-day basis. And I think that it's a good analog to that. Do you agree? Do you disagree? What do you, you know, any feedback on that before we get to the harder stuff?
No, I love that. And by the way, let me just first to state that I would make no claims on being, you know, in the leagues of von Clausewitz and so forth. So it is like I want to sort of disavow that. But sure. I think your characterizations of the three ways is, you know, I think is right on. And, you know, maybe a more recent understanding of this. Yeah, I think what I've been working on with Dr. Stephen Spear on is really trying to understand why do organizations work in the way they do, both in the ideal and not ideal. And I'm almost to the point where I believe that, you know, you can almost tell whether high performance exists or low performance exists just by looking at the communications within the organization. You know, is it dominated by communications going up and down the organization, up the hierarchy and then down the hierarchy, right? So up 8 levels just to go down 8 so 2 engineers can work together or 2, you know, specialists from 2 functional silos can talk to each other? Or is the communications really dominated by communications within the team and between teams with very little escalations? And if it has to escalate, it goes 1 level, not 8. And so I think, you know, the first way about flow is really to what extent are organizations that allow people who need to talk to each other to talk to each other, to do integrated problem solving, right? That doesn't have to involve 8 levels of escalations and back down. And, you know, feedback, we know, you don't want just feedback. You want fast feedback. You want, again, integrated problem solving, you know, not tickets, not memos, not emails, not requests for meetings, right? We really want that integrated problem solving. And then, you know, the third way, you know, I think that is just so much of one of my favorite books, you know, The Culture Code by Daniel Coyle, you know, it was all about studying special forces in the military, really how, you know, they've really codified, you know, how does one, in fact, I think that those words really came from Talent Code about, you know, repetition just being, you know, the prerequisite to mastery. So absolutely everything that you said resonates with me. And this is just merely kind of how my thinking has evolved. I think that really shows that these three things are as valid as they ever were.
Yeah. So Gene, thanks so much for amplifying some of the stuff that Kyle said too. And I think this wouldn't be the Phoenix Cast without us challenging ourselves a little bit on the call about how awesome we are at those three things. So I think one of the things that I'm very passionate about and kind of want to mention here is I honestly believe that the Marine Corps of the service components is brilliant at the battalion level and below. So what do I mean by that, right, for our listeners, right? We're talking about groups of about 1,000, you know, 1,200 to 1,000 people, right, being led, you know, by a group of officers that, you know, are empowered and resourced to go take care and do what we would call in the DevOps community is deliver value. You know, on the DoD side, we would say, you know, defend the nation, you know, at the forward edge of the battle area. So I think we're phenomenal at that level. And I think to your point, horizontal communication works really well at that level, mm-hmm. right? You see a lot of back and forth between platoons. You see a lot of back and forth between squads and fire teams below that level. And then you also see some back and forth between companies, which is one rung below the battalion level of about that 1,000-person organization. I think what's super challenging, and I'd love to get to this after we kind of talk through some other things on the cast, is how we do that effectively when we get above that 1,000-person organizational structure. Right. That's where I think the Marine Corps right now is doing the third way, where we're experimenting and we're taking risk with some of our technology initiatives that we've had the opportunity to kind of talk about on this cast in the past, whether it's, you know, looking at the entire corporate enterprise and infrastructure, upgrading its infrastructure and transport layers so that we can adopt some cloud-based services, right? Those are things that go across these 1,000 person organizations, and we've run into hurdles. But what's been awesome is mostly people have been willing to take down the roadblocks to that up and down communication to allow that horizontal stuff to occur. Thus the creation of Task Force Phoenix, and then the podcast to talk about it based upon the title of your book. So I'll stop there for a second and just say, I want to throw a quote out here by retired General Mattis, former Secretary of Defense Mattis. And Jim Mattis used to say, it's command and feedback, right? Most people in the Marine Corps think command and control or C2. And one of the reasons that folks loved to follow General Mattis anywhere he went was he knew he would give a command or drive direction for his organization and then immediately look for feedback loops because he knew war is something that you really can't control, right? So there's these interior feedback loops or interior lines of communication that kind of foster that horizontal talking. So anyhow, I'll stop ranting there. I'm super passionate to kind of talk about when we get above this 1,000-person level, which I believe below that we're brilliant, then we have some stuff to learn.
I love that. In fact, just to resonate with that, I had mentioned that I'm rereading a book I haven't picked up in probably about 15 years called Command and War by Martin von Krevold. And one of my favorite parts of that book is, you know, he's describing, you know, in during the Vietnam War, just because I think communications devices became cheap enough where you can deploy them, you know, at a scale never before, that, you know, you had captains on the hill having to talk to colonels in helicopters, talking to generals, you know, in orbiting 707, talking to someone at the Pentagon, right? And essentially it really deprived that captain on the hill to be able to make decisions on their own, right? You had, in fact, I think there was actually two orbiting layers of helicopters right before you got to the 707. So, you know, I think that's kind of the opposite of the communication style that we want. And I think what's been interesting to me, kind of working with Dr. Stephen Speer, is that we know that when collaboration, integrated problem solving happens kind of at that, you know, across, it can be very, very fast, right? But every level you go up, it becomes that much slower, right? And I think there's so many examples where, you know, by having that loop go too high, you know, suddenly you just can't act on opportunities fast enough, or you're making decisions based on data that's just very, very poor because you lose fidelity, you know, at every hop. Does that resonate? Is my interpretation of, you know, the Command and War book story resonate with you?
Yeah, I think it definitely resonates. And the thing I would say to kind of bring the two concepts together about Rich saying, hey, we're brilliant at the battalion level. And, you know, as we get a little bit higher, sometimes there's challenges. You know, at the battalion level, you have one commander, a battalion commander, a single person slated to command this unit. Everybody knows that is the person who is in charge. Very clear command and control. And we have a series of white books, MCDPs, Marine Corps doctrinal publications, that essentially say, don't be that guy who makes everybody go up five levels to you to answer this question. Like, it is very clear, not only in black and white, in a black and white book that, you know, to bring the colors like really vividly to you. There are black and white books that tell you, don't do that. Where I think it gets a little bit more challenging, and you know, maybe you can kind of give us a little feedback on maybe what you've seen to help with this. Some of the things Rich describes, there are five or six, either commanders or not commanders, each with their own version of intent or idea. And as they push down to the people that work for them, and to your kind of point of like getting one engineer to talk to another, that's a different commander with a different intent. And so even if we're super practiced at delivering our intent and saying what we want, intent across an organization where not everybody is necessarily working inside of the same line or with the same, you know, I've got eight bosses, Bob, you know, which one of the bosses' intents am I going off of? Have you seen that? And is there a, you know, click, here's what we do to help in that scenario?
Yeah, for sure. Which is why I was so intrigued by the interview that you did of Lieutenant Colonel Juliet Calvin and the notion of, and tell me if I, in fact, I'm going to sort of put this out hesitantly. So this was the most significant change of communications at the what level?
The battalion level.
Right. So if I understand correctly, the reason why, by the way, I thought it was just a phenomenal interview. And I think what she so clearly exhibited was an integration of technology and of networking, you know, communications, you know, into daily operations at a scale larger than would typically be managed at. That's what I got out of it. To what extent am I sort of understanding kind of that remit correctly?
I think you've got it.
Yeah. So, yeah, I think that was just, to me, that was so interesting because I think that does represent, you know, this desire to, you know, elevate the importance of communication infrastructure. And it's I think there's almost two kind of opposing forces at work that seem to be in opposition. One is, you know, I think in almost all endeavors, you know, we're trying to push the level of integration down, right? So in a hospital system, you have the cardiologist, you know, the radiologist, the people who are analyzing the, you know, MRIs and so forth, nursing, pharmacy, right? We don't want those daily interactions that each require an 8-level escalation, right? You know, we want those to be working kind of at that fast level, you know, at the team level and inter-team levels. But for really important things, right, we want thinking about technology integrated into all aspects of strategy and operations, right? So, you know, we want that elevated so that it's not someone else's job, right? That that everyone owns a piece of that. And so, you know, I think, you know, in your stories that you've told on the PhoenixCast, you know, I'm hearing hints of both of them. And both of them, I think, are, you know, marching exactly in the right direction. So does that resonate with you all?
Yeah, Gene, it definitely resonates with us. And I think the other thing, too, to mention that you you talked about earlier with Juliet is the novel instantiation of that network battalion was how do we coordinate what we do in user land, right, and our on our corporate environment with, you know, linking up that to how do we support our warfighters forward, right? And so the Marine Corps is still solving it. So the network battalion stood up and it did what you said. It kind of took some of these regional base post and station IT organizations, right? And it brought them under one commander to provide a vision and they can link up and support their customers from a user perspective. And I think what we're going through right now, which has kind of been awesome to watch, is how we're enabling the Marines that are either do IT inside of these tactical level units that we would call warfighting organizations. So some of these battalions that we were talking about before that actually are at the pointy edge of the spear. So that's where that seam between user land and warfighting applications and how do you support those functions right now, that's what we're ironing out. So it's been right now, it's just such a great time to be in the Marine Corps because we're going through that innovative change, if that makes sense.
And I love that story she told where, you know, she was able to prioritize at a far higher level. Right? And so where that when there was an accident, right, she could say, all right, we're going to put all, you know, sort of disruptive operations on hold because everything has to support, you know, that mission of, you know, notifying families and so forth. And I think that's something you can only do at a global level. And so I think that's, you know, why we need, you know, that technology managed with that kind of global perspective.
Yeah, that decentralized decision making.
Right.
Okay, so to talk more to Rich's point about it's a great time to be in the Marine Corps because there's lots of transformation happening, digital and otherwise. You know, Gene, you wrote the Phoenix Project in 2013, and then in 2019, you came out with a maybe not a direct sequel, but a almost sequel. It is a side story that explains the similar situation, but through a different lens. And in there, you launch this concept of five ideals that you can use. And I want to be a little bit of a contrarian for a second, because I actually think that these five ideals that you've outlined in the Unicorn Project are actually going to be kind of difficult for military organizations to adopt, where the three ways that you have in the Phoenix Project generally align wonderfully with military lines of thinking. I think that there's going to need to be some cultural transformation in the Marine Corps, which is what I have experience with, but generally military organizations, to try to get this. So again, for the listeners who haven't read the Unicorn Project, go do it. But the super TLDR is you've got the first ideal, which is locality and simplicity, which is where we need to simplify everything and make development teams like they should only have to do local code changes in a single location. It shouldn't impact other people. You know, you lower your blast radius. The second idea is focus, flow, and joy. Don't work on stuff that makes you sad. Only work on things that is advancing your organization and generally providing good value, and take the time you need to focus on that. Don't try to be distracted by 10,000 things. The third ideal is improvement of daily work. This is the age-old idea of let's get at least 1% better every day, and let's not adopt and, you know, bear hug technical debt on a day-to-day basis. You need to pay down your tech debt. You need to pay down your architecture and the choices that you've made yesterday that may not be the best choices for tomorrow. Then we have the fourth ideal, psychological safety. I feel like this has been a massive buzzword, if you will, over the last few years, is providing appropriate psychological safety, because all of the studies, we're going back to Dora and a bunch of other research out there, has shown that it is the most significant piece towards high-performing organizations, and especially in the military, and we'll get to this here in a second. Actually, I'm not going to spoil that. I'm going to get there in a second. And then the fifth idea is customer focus. And this is all about making sure that customers, and I'm going to steal some quotes from your book here, you give a definition between core and context in customer-focused thinking, as defined by Jeffrey Moore, which is where core is what customers are willing and able to pay for, the bread and butter of your business, and context is what they don't care about and what it took to get them that product, including all the back-end systems, HR, marketing, dev, and all that kind of stuff. And it's critical to look at these context systems as essential and mission-critical and fund them appropriately. But context should never kill core from a customer perspective. So given all those things, I want to start kind of at the easy one first, which is the psychological safety piece, because I think this is an interesting debate where in the military, especially the Marine Corps, America's 911 force, where we go anywhere, you know, we can go anywhere in the world in 24 hours and blow stuff up or, you know, provide humanitarian assistance or do whatever needs to be done, because that's what we do. Psychological safety is generally, you know, Marines tend to focus and worry much more about physical safety, like bullets and artillery and bombs and things that could actually put your life at risk. And psychological safety, especially along an IT or cybersecurity spectrum, seems to generally be at some form of odds of that. And I want to start with this fourth ideal, the psychological safety, and sort of open up this conversation between us to say, all right, where does psychological safety belong in the Marine Corps? Because it obviously does. And how do we balance that against the needs of the mission or the needs of the organization? And I think our previous episodes, we've interviewed a lot of generals and colonels who have had a lot to say on this issue. But Gene, I'm super interested to hear from you on what you think about that from a military lens, right? Like from a complete outsider's perspective, but who has a lot of informed conversations with important people.
Yeah, and I don't claim to be any expert in anything military, but...
No, but that's the best part. But, we have enough military experts on here. We need outside experts.
But yeah, I think it just stands to reason, right? I think there's a very logically inassailable case of why it's necessary, right? So, you know, I had talked in the Ideal Cast. We're trying to create this very parsimonious way of describing why organizations work the way they do. And, you know, I love the word parsimonious because, you know, they say the goal of science is to explain the most amount of observable phenomena with the fewest number of principles that confirm, you know, deeply held intuitions, reveal surprising insights. And so this parsimonious structure is really kind of, you have structure, right? The way you organize teams, the sanctioned interfaces between the components in the organization, maybe the software architecture we work within. And then dynamics is everything else, right? You sort of like let the machine go. And elements that affect dynamics are, you know, the ways that signals get transmitted and are received, right? And so do you create, are the dynamics one that weak signals are amplified, right, and is given quickly? Or do we have a culture that suppresses bad news? Everyone's afraid to tell bad news. So these weak signals of failure are extinguished entirely. And so you can't say what you really think. You can't transmit important signals if, you know, people are afraid to do so. So the Project Aristotle, Project Oxygen study, you know, is just this another amazing cross-population study. Very, it actually predates the DORA study, the State of DevOps Research. And, you know, it was on a quest to understand what made great teams great. And simply put, what they found across 60,000 respondents, across 300 teams, across, you know, I think it was 8 to 10 years, was that the top factor was psychological safety, as measured by to what degree do members on a team feel safe to say what they really think without fear of ridicule, being made fun of, or being punished. And that was a higher factor that predicted team greatness over structure and clarity of work, the importance of the work, you know, the and so forth. So, you know, I think, you know, if feedback is important, right, it's pretty clear that, you know, we can all think of environments where it was just not safe to get feedback. And I think every study, you know, you can sort of say, you know, in the absence of feedback, right, the outcomes are never so good. So I'd love to hear you react to that.
Yeah, so I'll take that one. And really just a quick kind of follow up here. So I am a Marine Corps leader listening to you say that. I'm convinced. I need that safety thing. What would you recommend that I do? Because I'll just kind of like, you can attribute to John. I don't feel necessarily we sit within a system that necessarily is structured around psychological safety. So what would you say some changes are that Marine Corps leaders can take on to make it so that their subordinates feel a little bit more safe, to be able to experiment, to be able to put out that that opinion that they know probably isn't going to be popular because maybe they're attacking one of my sacred cows, something along those lines. What's the first couple things you tell a leader to work on to get after this?
Yeah. So I'll cite some of the people I respect, you know, such as Dr. Amy Edmondson at Harvard, Dr. Stephen Spear at MIT Sloan. And the advice goes typically something like this, that, you know, we all have circles of control, influence, and concern. So in general, we'd like to, you know, focus on areas that we can control, you know, influence we can, you know, influence where we can. And circles of concern are things like the weather, right? You can complain or lobby as much as you want, but you're not going to change the weather. So, you know, I think any leader, just by virtue of being a leader, you can do things like reward behaviors that you can model behaviors that you want, right? In other words, you know, be able to say, I don't know, right? Ask people what they think, reward people for, you know, speaking fearlessly, by giving, you know, good feedback to everyone around them, amplifying that feedback. You know, so much of organizations is everyone will pick up what gets rewarded. And so I think any leader, you know, within their area of control is responsible for creating conditions of psychological safety, because that's what we need in order to get things done right. So I love the book Thinking Fast and Slow by Kahneman and Tversky. I mean, it's a big book, but you know, I think what that shows is that all of us, right, have biases, and that's just the way our brains are wired. We love making decisions with the fast part of the brain because it uses less energy, right? It actually takes a lot of work to get ourselves into the more analytical, higher cognitive load. And so when you have broad perspectives, right, you're actually using kind of, you know, you're now having a disparate set of biases, right, where they can not necessarily cancel each other, but you end up with better decisions because, you know, these ideas are being talked about and you end up with better outcomes.
I'll also state that I had a military leader who has been a guest on this cast, Mr. Falavine himself. But this individual taught me to question my assumptions and my biases very early on in my military officership and leadership career. And generally speaking, I think all of us, no matter who you are in the military or otherwise, you can kind of tell when people are loosely and lightly like poking and questioning some decision that you have made or some choice that has been made, right? They sort of ask those leading questions with a rising intonation, like, why are we using this technology? And, you know, these like very innocent questions that are under the guise of like, hey, explain this to me because I don't necessarily know. And I've tried to train myself to listen for those particular pieces. And my favorite thing in the world to do from that perspective is to then challenge that individual who asked the questions and say, hey, go, if you, you know, go tell me why you think this is a good or bad idea. Go do some research, right? Force them to sort of educate themselves and come back to me. And I try to avoid having anything that I, you know, will no hills that I will die on from a technology or process improvement perspective. And I want to try and get other people to prove me wrong. I try to never be the smartest person in the room. If you are, go find a new room. That's why we always invite people much smarter than us on this podcast. And I think that that's a good way where we can try to, especially senior leaders where you've been doing this a while, like you're there, you've made it, you've got nothing really to prove at that point. Like, let some other people try to prove you wrong. And then when they do, celebrate the hell out of them, because how awesome is that?
Yeah, maybe I'll add one more kind of opportunity that unfortunately presents itself, you know, more often than we would hope, which is, you know, what happens when accidents occur, right? When there's an outage, when a change fails. And, you know, John Allspaugh, who's so famous to so many of us in the DevOps community, right? He gave a 2009 presentation, you know, with Paul Hammond saying we're doing 10 deploys a day, every day at Flickr, right? Which basically made the entire technology community like throw up in the aisles, right? Because it just was, it seemed so preposterous. I mean, I don't think we thought they were lying, but, you know, what sort of maniac would do 10 deploys a day when, you know, 10 deploys a year is, you know, so problematic for most of us. Anyway, so his area of focus has been on resilience engineering. And, you know, he talks a lot about how an incident is an investment that was made on your behalf without your consent, right? It is a learning opportunity.
Yes.
And so when people talk about blameless postmortems, really it is, you know, to what extent are we really capturing what happened, capturing with the highest fidelity possible what occurred so we can best formulate a response that can either prevent those issues from happening again or better, you know, detect and correct it in the future. And that requires honesty, and honesty requires, you know, absence of fear, right? And so I don't think any leader would actually say we want less honesty, right? And so therefore, you know, we need less fear. You know, we need situations that can allow people to discuss these things and, you know, document these things without fear.
So, Gene, I like that quote that you just said about mistakes give you an opportunity without your consent to learn about something, right? And to get a little bit better. And in the military, we actually have an analog directly for that, which is anybody who's ever been a junior officer listening to us, sometimes things go wrong and people do bad things or bad things happen. And you will get tasked to be that person, to be the shepherd of that learned information. And we call that a PI or a preliminary investigation or preliminary inquiry. I had to do a couple and I can't remember which I stands for. Rich, correct me.
Inquiry.
With the knife hand. Inquiry with a knife hand. Okay. And basically, the military already has a construct for this, where if something goes wrong and they need somebody to actually take a look at it, they will tap a random officer and say, you go figure out what went wrong and how to make it not go wrong in the future. And they don't pick anybody close to the particular incident itself. They pick someone purposely far away. And that person gets to talk directly to the commanding officer as part of their investigation. And they have unfettered and unlimited access to everybody and everything that was around the particular incident. And we just need a much less life and job disrupting version of that that doesn't cause every, you know, lieutenant and captain to go, oh, not a PI, and something that is actually an honor to be able to do, and something that is very useful to us as an organization to say, hey, we had an outage, or we had this crazy security vulnerability happen, or something like, how did this happen, and how can we, in a blameless postmortem type of way, identify ways to not let it happen again and put procedures or policies or automations or whatever in place to prevent it from happening in the future and causing such disruption.
And I have to ask, like, on a scale of 1 to 10, to what degree do you think there is a culture that allows people to say what they really think and say what they actually saw, you know, during those PIs? 1 is like none at all. 10 is like, it isn't an honor, right, to record, you know, the observations of everyone who's affected by it.
So I would say that from your original question of, like, on a scale of 1 to 10, what culture exists for somebody to express their opinion in a way that they don't fear any retribution? So I would say we're very close to the individual conducting the preliminary inquiry. We're on the high side of that, right? I would say somewhere between, probably not a 10, but we're somewhere between 6 and 9, right? Of that person actually knowing they're responsible, they're empowered, they have the authority, because it actually comes from the chain of command. They get a letter in writing saying, you're appointed, go do this. So on that side of it, from an administrative and authorities perspective, it's high, right? It's closer to an 8, 9, right? Then I think what kind of relates to General McChrystal's book in Team of Teams is when this trust component comes in, right? I'm going to throw a little credit out to John on the cast. You know, hopefully I can't see him, but hopefully he doesn't turn red in the face. But John is one of the best officers I've ever met in establishing trust relationships early. So John, while he gave me some credit earlier saying, hey, you know, Rich reached out to me, gave me a task, prepped me to come to the unit. John and I actually have the opportunity to work together right now on some projects that are wickedly challenging, like high end of wicked challenging for given definition of wicked, right? Having said that, we're really successful right now because John came in and just started establishing trust relationships. So when we start talking about this feedback loop, you know, that we've been talking about previously, whether it's Boyd, whether it's General Mattis, whether it's the dev SecOps community, right? Specifically, John has created these trust relationships which allow the feedback loops. And I think that's what varies from organization to organization. It's how much the leader has invested in establishing trust relationships. So In our current role, when we came to the unit, we asked, like, hey, we're going to go do this new mission. It's super cool. It's really rad. Like, what do you guys need from us? Big hand goes up from one of our Marines, who's a staff sergeant, and says, how about I do this? Can I plan this thing? And so this ability to install trust immediately, like, me and John could have said, nope, we got some clear guidance from higher. We know what we're going to do, right? Instead, we were like, it's all you, brother. What resources do you need from us, right? And I think then along the way, when they fail because they're empowered, the failure you assume is the leader, right? But not to get too far off track of your original question, I think when it comes to being empowered and having the right authorities, we're towards an 8. But then when you start to get into the, okay, now I'm in the meat and potatoes of doing this investigation, things are dicey. I might have run into some moral issues or some ethical issues that I need to expose within my chain of command. Then it becomes, hey, what does the leadership establish as a trust relationship to really get after these things? And I would say, depending on which unit you're at, which leader is running that organization, the Marine Corps has a culture of being a strong proponent of empowering to that level. But I would say that we're probably midway through that 10 range. I would probably grade us at a 5 or a 6, because I just don't think it's flat across the entire organization. I think you're going to run into different nuances with different leaders. I don't know, John and Kyle, if you agree with that or not, but
yeah, I just wanted to tack on real quickly. So when it comes to building trust relationships, and thanks for the nod, that's one of the things you can't do during the investigation. You can't be like, hey, you know, I've never really spoken to you. I'm generally not a trustworthy individual, but now we're doing an investigation. Totally trust me. No, that is trust that you're putting pennies in that trust bank.
That's right.
And if your balance is zero when the investigation starts, I can tell you what the paper is going to say at the end of the investigation. Leaders, build your bank of trust well before you need it, because you're not going to be able to establish it during.
If I may just add, I mean, I think this is what I'm referring to when I was making a suggestion that I think there are these norms and rituals and traditions in the military that, the courageous leaders who are, trying to transform technology can lean on to be able to say, hey, when I'm talking about this, I really mean that, right? And hopefully those dots connect, and then that can help accelerate, these type of transformations that we want.
All right, so I want to transition this over to a combination, because I'm going to get to the first ideal and the third ideal again from the Unicorn Project, which is the locality and simplicity and the improvement of daily work, which I think for people in a military mindset, those things are very closely related. And again, we talk about locality and simplicity. There is this dichotomy in the military around a unit, like a company, a battalion, whatever, wants to do a thing for themselves, but there is this line where they cannot support past it, right? And they have to go higher.
And I would even argue in, like, from an enterprise standpoint, and, we had Juliet on, kind of talk about this. Realistically, your enterprise simplicity very well may be my unit's complexity.
Yeah, that's right. And because of that, when we talk about improvements to our daily work, we see this dichotomy happen in a few different ways where, we want to get rid of technical debt and we want to do all these things. But at the same time, we are beholden to this process where to field new equipment, for example, takes years, right? We're talking about, deployments every, eclipse cycle or something, because it's just enormous. And we end up trying to, do more with less and all these other, marine isms of, I know it's going to take 2 years to get the next upgrade to my power supply, so I'm just going to wire this thing together and hope it works or something. And we see this sort of, it's really a struggle for a lot of Marines. At least it was when I was in. I have got to imagine that hasn't changed too much in the last few years, but John and Rich, please correct me. John is vigorously shaking his head. No, it's still the same. And I see this being one of the core difficulties that we end up having in the military is we want to empower all of the units to be able to self-sustain themselves at some point and to make sure that if they make a change, it doesn't blow up figuratively, not literally, it doesn't blow up something that will impact another unit's ability to, self-sustain themselves or do things. And at the same time, we have to improve these systems. So when we think about deploying code, right? I want to be able to deploy code without needing to involve six other people to deploy the code for me, right? I don't want to kick it over the wall or in the old silo model. But at the same time, I want to improve what I am doing in the deployment of code. I want to make it faster. I want to be able to do it more often. And we end up not being able to do that very well. Now, because of people like Rich and John and hundreds of other Marines that are working on or near them and across the entire Marine Corps, we are getting better at that. But Gene, how have you seen organizations sort of tackle those things where the logistics around getting better are so slow, but we have the desire, we have the capability, we have the ability, but all of the things that help deliver stuff, whether no matter what stuff is, by any definition of stuff, how do we overcome that?
Yeah, why don't we do the third ideal, just because it's easier. So improvement of daily work. And cool. So the notion of improvement of daily work, it even shows up in the Phoenix Project, the notion that improvement of daily work is more important than even daily work itself. And it's based on this premise that actually comes from lean manufacturing that says, the opposite of improvement isn't stasis, it's actually degradation, right? It actually came from Mike Rother. And I took a course from him in 2011 at the University of Michigan. And he said, you do this kind of process improvement step in a factory and you reduce the setup time, right? You reduce the manpower required to actually execute the work of that work center from, say, five people down to three. And then they came back like 6 months later and it was back up to five, right? And it was just kind of this story that really resonated with me is that, because entropy exists, because there is this pull of inertia, and the absence of improvement is not just stasis. We're lucky. Life would be easier if it were just stasis. The things that it gets worse. And so if you don't invest some amount of time, you know, in development world, if you put 100% on features and leave no time for paying down technical debt, the inevitable outcome is you will go slower and slower, and you soon you'll not be able to ship anything anymore forever, right? And I think anybody who's been in a coding context, you know, that should resonate with you, is because, you know, when you cut corners and if you don't pay that technical debt, you know, all the work around, you know, fixing outages, feature work, you know, goes down and down.
Yeah. And Gene, I've actually heard you say this a few times, where if you don't agree to like pay 20% of your normal time into technical debt now, you will agree to pay 100% of your time into technical debt later. And exactly. And when that happens, well, you're screwed. There's not much left to fix.
Yeah. And so kind of to make this tangible, that means you need leaders. You need to schedule this time. You need to allow, and not only allow your subordinates this time to buy down that technical debt, you need to actively schedule it. Get them to sit down and critically think about what are the things that are technical debt, and schedule for them to get after that. And I am also legally responsible to say at this point, go blue, because you mentioned University of Michigan.
That's awesome. Yeah, and yeah, I guess one of the questions I sometimes find intriguing, but also a little bit frustrating, is, you know, what do you do when you can't get permission to work on technical debt? And I think my my first reaction now, you know, after a decade plus of hearing this, is that, well, you know, it's actually your job, right? You don't need permission to do your job right. You know, if you need to take some capacity off the table, right, so that it's not negotiable, right, that's what you need to do. If you feel like there's a better way of working, right, part of your job as a leader is to, you know, find that capacity to do those experiments so that you can eventually show that it works, so you can build the business case to do more of it, right? And I think that's the classical pattern that we've seen, you know, within the DevOps enterprise community, which is, you know, you have these courageous leaders who are willing to take these risks, right, because they have moral certainty, right, that is the right thing to do. So, you know, and I think there's got to be some analogs within the military community around readiness, you know, I think in aviation, right? Of like, if you don't maintain your airplanes, right, they will fail in flight, right? You know, if you're lucky, right, they'll fail on the ground.
They'll fail in the tarmac. Right, that's exactly right. Yeah. They fail at the most inopportune moment. Murphy's Law of aviation.
Exactly right.
As it just so happens, yes, there are some metrics around readiness. I might have seen that once or twice.
And that's never free, right? Yeah, that doesn't happen by accident. That is an investment you make.
That's right.
You know, so that these things can work when you need them too. You know, I think the first idea of locality and simplicity, it really comes down to being able to allow changes to be made locally where the effects are only local, right? As opposed to potentially global in nature, or they affect some distant part of the system that we've never heard of, right? And now you're causing a problem for someone else. And you know, I think in the state of DevOps research, where this shows up is the role of architecture. And so just to share some of my own preconceived notions, you know, we found that architecture was one of the top predictors of performance. It was measured by to what degree can teams make large-scale changes to their parts of the system without permission from anyone else outside the team? To what extent can they do their work without a lot of fine-grained communication and coordination with people outside of their team? Right? Can they deploy and release their service on demand, independent of services it may depend upon? Yeah, this is one of my favorites. To what extent can they do their own testing on demand without the use of an integrated test environment? And if all those things are true, then you should be able to do, you know, production changes in the middle of the day with negligible downtime. And so that's really kind of that notion of loosely coupled architectures. And in contrast to that, right, if you have to do a deployment and it involves scores of teams, you know, then that means scores of tickets, right? It doesn't take a lot to go wrong before, you know, you're looking at, you know, weeks or months to get things done. And probably the outcomes aren't so good either. So, yeah, you know, I think that notion of coupling shows up. You were hinting at that, is that ideally you want units at whatever level to be able to operate independently without worrying about, you know, dependencies on another portion, or let alone accidents with another portion. I think there are some really good metaphors in the military about, like, you know, what are the conditions that allow teams to really be able to work with autonomy without a lot of communication, you know, maybe supported by communication across, but hopefully not a lot of communication up and down. Does that resonate with you?
Yeah, absolutely it does. And kind of immediately the thing I kind of thought about was just making sure that we're very clear in our communication on kind of what falls under that definition, right? Because And you kind of hit it on whether it affects other units or not, and just making sure that we're super clear with each other about what counts as that, right? Because, you know, the guy who's on insert Marine Corps base X might not know that by upgrading the operating system on their router, they're taking out maybe a pay system or something along those lines. So, you know, kind of there's a lot of understanding definitions, knowing your architecture, all that kind of stuff that definitely goes into that. But yes, I think that is something that probably needs to be a very clearly publicized goal is the way that resonates with me.
By the way, I remember in the first Phoenix Cast episode I listened to, I think there was some story about an Active Directory server that failed in Iraq or something, right? And I was like,
That's me. That's my guy. I have hired that dude twice more in my life, so I don't hold it against him. But yes, that was me.
I mean, so I think that's that's probably the nature of certain things are global, right? Those are the riskiest changes to make because, you know, if something goes wrong, you affect everything. And I think that's why, you know, there's so much energy around platforms these days, right? Where we're saying, all right, I'm going to hide that complexity for you, for the developer. You know, you will be able to independently deploy, test and deploy, independently develop, test and deploy value. So your customers say, thank you. And we're going to own all the responsibilities of, you know, making sure everything works, the environments are there, automated test suites run. And it's a way that you can contain that complexity in one place to liberate, you know, all the customers of that platform.
All right, I'm going to bring it back because you brought it up, Gene, just to say that if you can bring down Active Directory for an entire classified combat zone, and then I will still hire you again, even after that fact, in the civilian sector. That is psychological safety.
It's awesome.
So, Gene, I know we just got done talking about the book and kind of applying it to the military, but I wanted to give our listeners a chance to kind of hear, you know, what are you doing currently? Like, what is current and relevant and impactful in what you are doing, like, time now?
Yeah, there's really kind of three things on my plate for this year, and I guess the third is going to be something I've really haven't talked about in public ever. So I'll get to do it for the first time here.
Hot take.
Yeah.
Yes.
So the first thing that is coming up in 6 weeks is the DevOps Enterprise Summit, and so I mentioned that my area of passion since 2014 has been studying how DevOps is being used by large, complex organizations that have been around for decades or centuries. And, most well-known brands across every industry vertical. And it has been such a delight that over 12 events, we've had, 500 plus leaders, present their experience reports in a really, a simple format. You know, here's our organization. Here's how we compete. Here's where I fit in the org chart. Here's a business problem we set out to solve. Here's what we did. Here's what happened. Here's the problem still remain. And so, as an adult learner, as a leader, right? We don't typically learn from experts telling us what they think we should do. We really learn from watching other leaders solve problems. And so for me, it's just one of the highest learning formats that I've ever had in my career. And so I was so delighted last year, as I mentioned, we had Adam Furtado and Lauren Knessenberger from Kessel Run tell their story, both at Kessel Run and the U.S. Air Force at large. And one of the things I'm so much looking forward to is finding other pockets of greatness that are being created, doing software in the military, to share those stories as well, because I think it's important, and not just for that military service, but for the nation in general. The second thing I've been working on is, like you, I'm on a learning journey, and so I've been doing this podcast called The Ideal Cast, and as John mentioned, I had the privilege of interviewing Admiral John Richardson. So he was Chief of Naval Operations for 4 years. And that was just one of these, it was just an exhilarating experience to really get a glimpse into how senior military leaders are trained. And even this interview today has shown there's so much in that body of knowledge that you live and breathe every day that are useful tools and techniques and principles that every technology leader should be familiar with. So I think it wouldn't surprise me if in 10, 20 years that, those kind of the forms of what leadership looks like, are increasingly familiar, not just in the military, but in civilian world as well. And the third thing that I haven't really talked about publicly is we're in the early stages of a book. I'm working with Dr. Stephen Speer. So he's a lecturer at MIT Sloan. He wrote the most widely downloaded Harvard Business Review article of all time called Decoding the DNA of the Toyota Production System. And I'm just going to tell the story because it's so funny. That was actually based on his doctoral dissertation at the Harvard Business School, which in service of that, he actually worked on the plant floor of a tier one Toyota supplier for 6 months. So like, you know, that's dedication and commitment. So anyway, you know, we're so much of the ideal cast is really trying to learn what I feel like I need to learn in order to really come up with a good answer of like, why do organizations work the way they do? And, you know, what do we actually need to kind of transform from maybe 100 years of Taylorism that, you know, are a cohesive set of beliefs and practices and patterns that lead to things like, you know, waterfall software development or, you know, over controlling command and control, you know, Gantt charts dictating everything to, you know, if I could wave a magic wand, this book would really kind of frame why tools and techniques such as psychological safety or team of teams or Toyota Production System or, you know, what allowed us to harness the atom or send a man to the moon, right? What are the underlying principles that really made greatness occur? So those are the three things that if all goes well, that will be the majority of the time I spend this year.
Wow.
Oh, man, that is wickedly exciting. And I at least know that when you've got a title out, I'll know yes. what to put on our
In fact, how's this? I'll add you all to the early readers. The first, when we have something to show, I'll add you to the list. I would be honored if I could get your honest and candid feedback.
Absolutely.
Yes. That is awesome, exciting, and something to look forward to, because I need a good something to look forward to from time to time.
You know I mean? Yeah, even in 2021, I'm really looking forward to things in the future. You know what I mean?
No longer pandemic future. Yes.
Yes.
So much to look forward to.
Hey, can I add one more thing?
Of course.
Hey, yes, please.
So I'd love to tell you one more thing on the good news front. So last week, I got to get a behind the look with the chief operating officer of Legacy Healthcare. This is one of the four major healthcare systems here in Oregon. And I got to see the vaccination clinic at the Portland Convention Center. So they're doing 8,800 vaccinations per day. And that's up from 250 a day even 4 months ago. So they went from 250 to 800 to 1,200 to, you know, now 8,800. And it's just amazing to
Holy
see
smokes.
Just to what extent, you know, human creativity is being unleashed in service of the most important mission on the planet, right? Which is, you know, vaccinate as many people on the planet. Wait, hang on. Vaccinate everyone on the planet, right? In the shortest possible time.
Yes.
And, you know, I think I just have so much conviction that, you know, that energy is, you know, going to translate not just to vaccination clinics, but to healthcare in general. That and just even hear kind of stories of the lessons being learned by the top leaders in these healthcare systems, figuring out, okay, this is not just for vaccination clinics. This should be incorporated in the way we deliver healthcare, whether it's cardiac surgeries, hip replacements, you know, emergency departments. And so that is something I just find very hopeful, exciting, and inspirational.
I love it. And on our hopeful, inspirational note, I am ready for Kyle to hit us with a hopeful, inspirational hot take. Bring us home, Kyle.
All right. I'm going to riff on something that Gene said earlier, where he said he wanted to take an additional opportunity to provide some feedback amongst this group. And I want to just throw this out here to the leaders, the listeners, everyone who's sort of listening to this cast. Gene's body of work gives you an opportunity to take a holistic view at how you do what you do, whether in the military or outside the military. These are tools that will help you in your day-to-day execution of anything. So please, on behalf of all the hosts, try to at least go get through the Phoenix Project. I highly recommend you read everything that Gene has written, book format, including the one that is yet to be released that we just heard about. So take this additional opportunity to improve yourself personally and professionally through Gene's work.
Love it. Thanks for hitting us with that hot take, Kyle. And dear listeners, thank you so much for joining us. You can connect with us on social media by going to Twitter and following at @USMC_TFPHOENIX. That's @USMC_TaskForcePhoenix. Our editor is Sarah Clarkson, and marketing support is provided by Hector Alejandro. You can support the cast by going to Apple Podcasts and leaving us a 5-star review and a hot comment. And with that, we are out.